In 2013, for the first time in over 50 years, West Kentucky coal mines produced more than their eastern counterparts.
Coal companies employ more than 4,000 people in 10 West Kentucky counties, and more than 90% of the Commonwealth's power comes from this ancient mineral.
But there's much more beyond these numbers. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. Over the next hour, we'll explore West Kentucky coal, its people.
You know, we work in the dark so everybody else don't have to.
Places.
People were born here and they died here. They didn't leave.
And power.
This is what a lot of people are calling war on the coal.
Join us. Welcome back to West Kentucky Coal, People, Places, and Power. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton.
A recent text message to producer Austin Ramsey read, "Are you ready to plunge more than 800 feet underground tomorrow?" Under any circumstance, such a message might seem a bit troubling, and today for two journalists it did spark a little bit of apprehension. That text message came from Steve Henry, who's a veteran coal miner and face boss for his unit at Warrior Coal's Cardinal Mine No. 2. Henry is one of the more than 4,000 people employed by coal companies in 10 western Kentucky counties. The Cardinal Mine offices sit on top of the No. 11 coal seam and a maze of tunnels filled with machinery and workers that stretches more than 11 miles. With hard hats, coal miner headlamps, and a GPS tracking unit, the three of us are headed underground.
We're going to be getting on our elevator here. As you can see, it's a 16-person capacity elevator. This is also that intake shaft where the air is going down. As you get ready to step up, as you'll notice, we're standing over about an 800-foot drop. That's something that I don't know that I'll ever get 100% used to, is standing over that. Now, if you can take that in comparison to size, I believe that the Batman building in Nashville is about 630 foot. So we're actually going to be dropping in deeper than the length of what the AT&T building is in Nashville. Whenever you get on, it's very simple.
There are two buttons, up or down. It takes about 4 minutes to drop into the mine. The suction of air coming through the shaft is deafening when the elevator hits the bottom. The fresh air moving through this tunnel circulates through the miles of pathways to flush out the poisonous and flammable gases released when chewing through coal. When Henry opens the elevator's metal door, the three of us walk out into a mined seam of Kentucky coal. Murray State geologist George Kippett.
Well, coal, and particularly Kentucky coal, is the remnants and remains of vegetation that grew long ago, that's accumulated in large amounts in certain special types of environments, particularly marshes and wetlands. The remains of that material has been buried and heated and compressed and subject to biological activity. And over the course of millions of years, it has been transformed from vegetation into the substance that we call coal. Similar processes can also result in the production of oil and natural gas.
An easy way to remember some details about West Kentucky coal is to think of three U.S. states. Kentucky coal is found in the Illinois Basin that was formed during the Pennsylvanian period, which occurred between 325 and about 300 million years ago. Kippett says during that period, and for much of Kentucky's geological history, the Commonwealth was under ancient seas and near the equator. Back in the mine, we board a four-person diesel ride. It's short and squatty to navigate some low roof areas, but in general, this mine has about 6 to 7 feet of clearance. Our miner headlamps light up the path ahead of us while Henry prepares us for our meeting with the unit.
There's only one thing that really upsets a coal miner, and it's probably the worst thing you can do is to put your light in his eyes. If you notice, most people think that coal miners keep their hat cocked just a little bit because they want to look cool. But the reason actually they keep it cocked a little bit is because they're looking here, but their light's shining there, yeah. So I can look at you in the face, yeah. But yet my light is shining over to the side of you.
On our way to the face of the mine, we're stopped by 32-year mining veteran Tracy Brashear, whose job with Cardinal is to maintain 6 miles of belts that transport coal out of the mine. He's covered in sweat and coal dust.
Well, you know, my great-granddad mine, granddad mine was a miner, my dad was a miner, so, you know, we work in the dark so everybody else don't have to. I've done it all. Belt mechanic, car driver, pin man, loader man, miner man, cutter man, face boss. Nah, I worked 13 years on surface.
What do you prefer, underground or above ground?
Well, outside.
Yeah.
You know, golly, you may be stupid not to work outside where you see the sun and the stars.
Brashear has recently recovered from open heart surgery and says he feels better than he has in a decade, but not good enough to tell us how he received his nickname, Feeder Pig, which is printed on a label on the side of his miner hat.
I want to know how you got your nickname.
I'm not going to tell
you. You can't tell me. Is it offensive? Is it R-rated?
No.
Oh.
I've had that name since I was in the fifth grade.
So no story about Feeder Pig?
No, not today.
Well, if you change your mind.
All right, tomorrow's not looking good neither.
All right. Well, what's your nickname, Steve?
I don't have one.
I don't believe it.
No, really, I don't.
I thought you said every coal miner has a nickname.
Almost every coal miner.
Except for Steve.
Yeah, except for me.
In his 32 years of mining, Feeder Pig says he's never witnessed a fatality, but he has been injured.
Well, I got mashed between a scoop and a rib.
A scoop picks up loose coal, and a rib is the wall of the mine.
I'd been in the mines 4 months, and I just climbed out of the deck of the scoop, and another scoop come by and caught the bucket and pushed it over the rib, and I was about halfway out of it. Had 2 broke ribs, pinched my leg pretty good right there in that muscle. I was on crutches for about 6 weeks.
Underground coal mining is no doubt a dangerous job. Along with avoiding massive pieces of machinery operating in pitch dark, miners are constantly aware of possible roof falls or wall failures and monitoring air quality. Advances in technology and increased safety regulations have made coal mining much safer, but Steve Henry is acutely aware of the risks of going down in a coal mine.
I have an absolute routine that I do each day, but it's not one that I take for granted. I'll go to my daughter's room and I'll kiss her bye and tell her that I love her. I'll go down to my son's room. I'll kiss him goodbye, tell him that I love him, and then I'll do the same for my wife. And I do not know of a day, unless I've been on a different shift, that they've been home, that I've not kissed them and told them that I loved them before I left. And then on the work, there's not a day that's went by that I can remember that I didn't pray somewhere along the way for God just giving me the wisdom and the patience and understanding that whatever comes before me that day, that I'll make the right decision.
Henry and Brashear say they're both lucky enough to have never witnessed a fatality while working in an underground mine. But Warrior Coal, which operates the Hopkins County mine, has had its share of tragedy, with 3 accident-related fatalities in their mines since 2001. Most miners agree one of the more dangerous jobs in an underground coal mine is that of a pinner. Pinners follow the continuous miner and drill 4-foot holes into the unsupported roof and insert an epoxy and steel rods with bottom plates every 4 feet. Steve Henry.
You have 2 operators on each side of it. They work as a team. The thing about a pin man is he's walking where no man's walked before, or at least for a long time. Even though that miner man is minded, that miner man has stood underneath the pins. And what they'll do is they'll pull up and they'll put the pins in.
Jason Dirks is a pinner on today's crew, and of course he has a nickname.
What's your nickname?
Dirks.
Dirks?
Yeah.
So is it just based on your last name, nothing special?
Nothing special for me.
Dirks has been a pinner for 3 years and understands the dangerous nature of his job.
Nah, you get used to it.
Yeah.
Make sure to listen and be aware at all times.
What lets you know something's not right?
Popping, cracking.
Yes, those popping and cracking noises that you hear are chunks of coal popping off the walls around us.
Things taking way. You can judge by just basically sound and looking at it.
Dirks and every other miner that we've encountered on this trip are second or third generation miners. And as an 18-year veteran face boss, Steve Henry says these miners are here because they want to be.
I think there is a persona that people have that a coal miner is a victim, because when you start seeing lobbyists and different ones that take different sides of the picture, one of those sides that people take is that coal miners are oppressed and they're having to almost be forced into working in the coal mines because that's the only choice that they have, which is absolutely false. We all have choices. I mean, we choose to come and do our jobs each day, and I think we're very intelligent people. We're able to go and do a job that not everybody can do, and I think that we take a lot of pride in what we do. There's people that wants to argue that we need to do away with coal mining simply because how that it hurts the people and how that coal miners are somewhat not able to think for themselves. And I don't want us to have that perception. I don't want people to think that. I mean, we go and do a job. It's a job that becomes part of us. Both my granddads was coal miners. My dad was coal miner. Just almost all my uncles was coal miner. My father-in-law was coal miner. My brother-in-law was coal miner. I mean, it actually becomes who you are.
It's understandable that when people identify as a coal miner, that the mining aspect sticks with them for the rest of their lives. Whitney Jones tells us the story of one miner after leaving his last shift in an underground coal mine.
Mike Foster, here in Greenville, Kentucky, a coal mine for Peabody for 34 years. Old coal miners used to have a saying, when you bleed coal dust, you're a coal miner.
Coal hangs with a miner. Coal provides their loved ones and neighbors with electricity. Coal gives them another much larger set of brothers. Coal is maybe even their lifelong career. But for some of these men, coal hangs with them literally. Not in their blood, but in their lungs.
I have second stage black lung. If you ever around a coal miner, been a coal miner, you know he's a coal miner. He's constantly coughing and grunting because it feels like something hung in his lungs all the time.
Foster, who's a little red in the face and wears a working man's ball cap, mined underground. In his early years in the mine, workers didn't use water to keep the coal and rock dust down, so it's no surprise he has the respiratory disease. But listen to this retired miner's breakfast. Notice what you don't hear? Here, take another listen. Not a single cough. All those characteristic grunts are missing at Hobby's Classic Food in Greenville. That's the monthly meeting place of United Mine Workers of America's local chapter. Spooning heaps of eggs and ingesting greasy meats isn't exactly the kind of work that takes the retiree's breath away. Also, early stages of black lung often don't have any symptoms. Foster says coal miners suffer other blights, too.
Like most coal miners, my back is messed up because you walk bent over and lifting. The same thing you do outside, you're bent over doing everything, lifting, pulling, tugging. You're running big equipment in there, banging all the time. It affects your hearing.
While health issues plague many miners in retirement, for decades men have faced danger inside the mines. Foster's father also worked in an underground mine. Foster says his dad went deep into the ground for almost 50 years.
My dad made about 50 cents a day. The man would give $200 for the mule, and the company would say, I give $200 for the mule. We don't want him hurt. Didn't care what happened to the man. A man would get killed. You study history, and they wouldn't even stop working. They lay him on against the rib, bring him out for a load of coal. They wouldn't even stop working.
That's why Foster is a union man. With the union came tighter safety regulations and higher pay. But even with safety improvements during Foster's time underground, he still experienced his fair share of danger.
I had to run out myself, and when I made the turn to get out, it shot me out. The rock was that close. Just the little rocks was falling out of the top, hitting on my back as I run and I turned. But when I made the turn, the whole place fell in. The pressure pushed me out. When rock falls, it falls in big layers. It'll all be anywhere from 2 foot to 20 foot.
Foster entered the mines at a young age. To him, the choice was a natural one. But many men just can't handle that long, dark trip into the coal mine. Foster recalls going down an old mine shaft in Muhlenberg County.
We was dropped down at Markwick on a cable car, and if you look back, you just see the hole start closing off, and it bothered a lot of men. when you start going out and you start looking back, a lot of men couldn't take that, just seeing it looked like they were shutting down, but it ain't. I've seen good men, it was great workers. When they go underground, they just couldn't stand it. Everybody's not an underground coal miner. And I'm out of a family of 8 boys, and I'm the only coal miner.
Foster says the men who are cut out for the life of an underground miner form an inseparable bond. Looking around Hobby's Classic Food, it looks like these men share more than just brotherhood. They wear the same clothes, a variation of plaid shirts and jeans. But no matter their fashion sense, having these brothers comes in handy when there's a fight. That sound is the UMWA chapter president slamming a coffee mug on the table to quiet down the retirees and start the union meeting.
We all work for Peabody Coal Company, almost every one of us. And it's not fair that after we worked all these years for them, and they're still the biggest coal company in the world, and want to get rid of us. And we, see another thing, man, I like to clear it. We worked for $5, $6 less on the hour than other unions that they would furnish us insurance when we got old. They have not kept their promise.
Since that meeting, Peabody and its spinoff Patriot Coal have come to an agreement with the union workers. The Eighth Circuit Court ruled Peabody is responsible for the some 3,100 retirees' benefits and cannot use Patriot's bankruptcy to escape its obligations. Even though the retirees aren't getting the rest they expected after leaving the mines, Foster and many of the other miners stay dedicated to coal.
It ain't the cleanest living, but it's good. And if I was a young man and wanted to go make a living in this area, I'd go in a coal mine.
And compared to the thousands of people working in Western Kentucky coal mines today and the many who've retired from mining, the labor force with connections to the coal industry is just as vast. They include prep plant and power plant employees, vendors for mine equipment and infrastructure, transport companies.
And let's not forget the federal and state inspectors, and each of them has a different story to tell.
Coming up, as coal leaves the mine on miles of conveyor belts, it makes its way into West Kentucky communities.
And we'll explore these places of coal, including the lost community of Paradise, life atop a reclaimed mine, coal's connection to medical research, and one of two Kentucky coal miner clinics. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. You're listening to West Kentucky Coal, People, Places, and Power. Welcome back to West Kentucky Coal, People, Places, and Power. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Once Western Kentucky coal emerges from deep underground, a lot of it, like Dante from the Inferno, goes to Paradise, some 20,000 tons a day. Tennessee Valley Authority's Paradise Steam Plant is Kentucky's largest coal-fired plant, and it takes its name from the small riverside town John Prine made famous.
When I was a child, the family would travel down to Western Kentucky, where my parents were born. And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where Paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train is hauling it away. Then the coal company came with the world's largest shovel, where they tortured the timber and they stripped all the land. Then they dug for the coal till the land was forsaken, and then they wrote it all down as the progress of man.
Paradise is indeed lost, but it wasn't Mr. Peabody's coal trains that took it away. And it wasn't Peabody's 10,000-ton Big Hog shovel that stripped the land. P&M Coal worked that area, and they were still doing it when Prine recorded Paradise in 1971. By that point, the town itself had only been gone 4 years. At the start of World War II, 100 people lived and worked in Paradise, some of them in nearby mines. A generation later, they were all gone. The history is still there, though. Kentucky's first commercial mine, the McLean Drift Bank, which opened in 1820, is just north of town. And then there are the stories, like how Paradise got its name.
I'm Barry Duval. I live in Central City, Kentucky. I love history.
You had the Stumbs Landing, and then it was some 20-something years later, they changed it briefly to Monterey for a period. But then there was a woman here that looked at the place, and she said, with these magnificent timbers and all this lush farmland, and it has to be Paradise. Then there's one that a woman yelled it from the flatboat as they were coming. She said, this is where we're going to live. This is obviously Paradise. The third reason that I read, and this all happened between 1830 and 1840, is that there was a young child that was sick traveling down the river, and they docked here late in the evening. And when they all went to sleep that night, they woke up the next morning, the child was up playing, and the woman said, we must be in a holy place, and this must be Paradise. So those are the three different versions of that I've heard why the town got named.
After World War II, more and more of Paradise's young people moved away for opportunities elsewhere. But in the 1950s, TVA brought opportunity to town, a massive coal-fired power plant just to the south. In fact, the road leading to the plant's barge-loading facility on the Green River runs through what once were backyards of homes on the old Main Street. And about a mile west as the crow flies from those backyards are some of the only indications the town was ever there, a pair of cemeteries. McDougal lies just off the Rockport Paradise Road, with graves ranging from the Civil War all the way to April of 2013. Weir sits a half mile further west, surrounded by the old P&M strip mine. On one sunny afternoon, a group of men are there, clearing thick brush from around the couple dozen headstones, some of which date back to when the Jackson Purchase still belonged to the Chickasaw. It's a tiny plot of land, and that's the thing. According to the original 1858 deed, it's supposed to be 3 acres, but it isn't.
P&M turned this ground over to TVA. And according to TVA, their records show the cemetery's only a half acre. My name's Milton Akins. I was born down here, was raised in Louisville, Kentucky, and I live in southern Indiana. And they falsified the documents that they give TVA. I remember when I was a little kid, my mother and grandmother was talking what they done to Oliver. He went to sue a coal company here, and he was a blind man. And he went to town by himself, and he signed away, his attorney had him sign away all the mineral rights to this big farm here for nothing. And then they come back and desecrated the cemetery. And that's what bothers us the most. It's bad enough to cheat a blind man.
My name is J.D. Masters, and I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. Anything that didn't have headstones to it, if there was just graves like out in there, then mine it. And I've heard several people told me that they had heard stories where coffins come up out of the ground and they just keep on rolling. And one guy told me that they'd come up on a little family cemetery and the stones was still there. And they told the guys driving equipment to go right on through it. And he refused to do it. And he told her he left, and supposedly he come back to work the next day and that the area had already been stripped. But they said that they stripped right up beside the cemeteries when they're supposed to be 100 feet away from them.
And that's the law. You're supposed to stay back 100 feet from a cemetery. And according by the law, they should have stayed back 100 feet from the 3 acres.
Yeah.
We have a lot of work to do out here, but it'll get done.
This restoration aside, the only work going on in Paradise is at the plant. But despite the work TVA offered when the facility opened, people kept leaving. During the less environmentally conscious 1960s, falling ash from the plant got locals worried about their health. So when TVA offered to buy out the remaining residents, no one refused. On November 17, 1967, Postmaster J.H. Buchanan sent out his last bag of mail and then locked up Paradise's post office for the last time. And that was that. It's easy to get a little sentimental about Paradise's story and its fate as a victim of, as John Prine puts it, the progress of man. But when Prine released his song in 1971, it was a prime case of not letting the facts get in the way of a good story. Peabody Coal was less than pleased with the liberties Prine took. They came back with a facts versus Prine campaign. Agnes Harrelson, who was Muhlenberg County historian at the time, was less sentimental. In the mid-70s, she wrote, "Many think the Paradise area, where the land is being reclaimed, has better prospects today than it ever had before." As for the loss of Paradise to progress, the final word goes to Postmaster Buchanan. He was quoted in 1974 as saying that he and his wife wouldn't move back to Paradise, even if it were there.
Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay. Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late and ask it. Mr. Peabody's coal train is a haunted way. Mr. Peabody's coal train is a haunted way. Mr. Peabody's coal train is a haunted way.
When the coal trains have hauled away all the coal in a strip mine, there's one thing left. What do you do with the land?
Well, in Paradise's case, TVA acquired the property and built coal ash retention ponds for the plant.
But in the reclamation of old mine lands elsewhere, there are two eras, pre-law and post-law. The law in question is the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act of 1977.
It states mined land must be returned to its approximate original contour, with the exception of mountaintop mining operations.
Reclaimed sites in Kentucky have become airports, correctional facilities, even fish and wildlife refuge areas.
Currently, there are six active reclamation projects in western Kentucky. John Null visited one in Madisonville.
We used to be just called abandoned lands. Yeah, I think, right?
Orphaned lands.
That's what it started out at.
In the 60s and early 70s,
that's right.
They were called orphaned lands.
Between the two of them, Adam Humphrey and Lloyd Gilmore have almost a half century of experience with the Kentucky Division of Abandoned Mine Lands. But they're trying something completely new in Hopkins County, just southeast of Madisonville. We're overlooking a pool of rusty, penny-orange water contaminated by iron.
The objective here was to treat the water in the basin. The engineers in Frankfort have come up with this design to slowly keep some retention time in the basins to allow that water to essentially filter through the layers that we've created here with the bark mulch, the hardwood bark mulch, the compost, and then with the cattail plantings. What we're trying to create here is a man-made wetland.
AML West Kentucky Supervisor Adam Humphrey is describing the plan for Earl's Creek, a small stream flowing through the site of a former surface mine. For this project, AML has constructed a series of seven mounds, consisting of a foot of limestone rock, 3 to 4 inches of limestone sand, then several feet of what Humphrey calls wetland compost substrate. These mounds will filter the spoiled water. This technique has never been implemented by the AML before.
This is our first one, really. We're looking at trying to implement these in some other sites in our design process, and I think a couple other mines have actually, active mines, have visited the site and are kind of interested on what kind of results we're going to end up getting out here to use on active sites.
The AML's work deals mainly with mines that have been vacant for several decades, namely those abandoned before the 1977 Reclamation Act became law. Humphrey says coal companies are more accountable now. They're doing such a good job in cleaning up their active mines, the AML won't have as much of a burden to shoulder in coming decades.
You don't see mines forfeiting today like you did 10 or even 15 years ago. It's just harder for them to do it. And, you know, when you forfeit a mine, you're essentially, you can't do business with the state anymore. So that means you can't, you know, your company, the people in charge, can't technically mine in the state and get a permit in their name. And yeah, I think the coal industry by far is doing a whole lot better job in mining, in recovery, and in reclamation.
Humphrey says there isn't much that can be done in the reclamation of an underground coal mine besides covering the entrance. Humphrey says anything can be built on them given the proper preparation. He recommends reading the AML's development guide before building or moving onto coal fields. Former Hopkins County miner turned auto mechanic Jerry Neiswanger knows the possible consequences all too well.
We discovered in August of 2009, I was leaving on a business trip, we had a small crack inside the structure of our house. And I told my wife to contact a carpenter to come over because we had what we called ceramic tile countertops. And I left out. That was on a Thursday morning.
When he contacted his wife Saturday morning, Neiswanger found out things had gotten worse, a lot worse.
I said, "What's going on?" She said, "Well, I'm moving." She said the house had fell far enough that it had separated the house roof from the garage roof. It had fell almost 17 inches in a matter of just 3 to 4 days.
Neiswanger's home sat atop an underground coal mine. Mine subsidence is when an underground coal mine collapses and results in direct damage to a structure. Homeowners insurance policies exclude coverage for losses arising from mine subsidence. So, in 1984, the Kentucky legislature enacted a law that established the Kentucky Mine Subsidence Insurance Fund, which allows residents of 37 Kentucky counties to purchase insurance coverage for property losses caused by an underground coal mine collapse.
After we got into the house and got to look, and we found the chimney was broke in three different places, there was walls. It was like walking through one of these funny houses at the circus, how the walls and the floor would lean and everything. You find yourself just leaning over on the countertop. It was sad. Doors wouldn't shut. That we had about like a 6-inch crack at the top of the living room wall to where the walls had just literally pulled apart from themselves.
Neiswanger had one of about 50,000 policies in place in the Commonwealth. And according to the Kentucky Department of Insurance, 80% of all mine subsidence claims come from western Kentucky. But only 15% of claims turn out to be actual mine subsidence events. The former coal miners is one of the 15%.
All said and done, we like just a few centimeters going almost 2 foot on one end of the house. So, yep, if you're going to live over old abandoned underground mine, I would recommend underground mines of Sider's insurance.
Neiswanger's house was deemed structurally unsafe and demolished. But despite the experience of having his house sink into the ground, Neiswanger still proudly displays his old mining helmets in his shop's office.
That story came from John Knoll.
So coal not only takes from the land, it can take the land itself. Still, coal does give back. Kentucky producers pay a state tax on every ton of coal processed and shipped.
Half that money stays in the general fund. The other half goes back to coal-producing counties in the form of development projects.
But with coal production leveling off, that revenue tap is in decline. Nevertheless, in Webster County, it's a good way to diversify the economy and ease a dependence on underground production.
Austin Ramsey tells us the story of how Webster's school district is aiming those benefits at the students.
That's a sound you don't hear all that often in any of Webster County schools. It's the distinguished startup tone for an Apple computer. It's not that these schools don't have any. In fact, it's hard to find anything but. Computers are never turned off here. They stay on all day and night, weekends and holidays. Not exactly a common practice in public schools. Here's English teacher Aaron Harrell.
Now I have to stress the opposite of that daily. Don't log them off. Please leave them on. Just leave them alone. You know, log yourself out, but don't turn the machines off.
Why, you may ask? Why even does one of Kentucky's smallest and poorest school districts have a full line of brand new iMacs? Well, it's called the DataSeam Project.
Well, DataSeam is a non-for-profit company based in Louisville, Kentucky, that takes coal severance money from the state to purchase computers that are in turn put in schools.
That's Webster County's network engineer, Mike Stone. He says DataSeam serves two roles in the state. A group of entrepreneurs and Kentucky businessmen realized the need for technology and related equipment in public schools. The men knew that computers linked together on a single network can significantly increase computing power. One of those men, Brian Gupton, a Princeton native, also realized that a community's economic development is dependent on its schools.
Part of that is, you know, placing the computers in schools as opposed to building a giant data center and, you know, building a traditional supercomputing asset.
Gupton and his fellow entrepreneurs set out to create a network of computers in Kentucky's public schools that work together to benefit the University of Louisville's James Brown Graham Cancer Center. At night, computers stay on to give the servers in Louisville the extra power to duplicate mathematic equations at higher speeds. Since 2005, the General Assembly has approved the use of coal severance monies to pay for the computers in coal-producing school districts.
This has never been done before anywhere. And what has, you know, come of it is that we have a infrastructure piece that's in nearly a third of the state, impacting over 100,000 students. It's driving research and making it more competitive. And it's become the largest grid of its kind on the face of the planet.
The coal taxes have put more than 17,000 computers in coal-producing school districts. DataSeam has helped about 6,000 educators with off-site training, and the company has donated almost $2 million in college scholarships to Kentucky students. Gupton says the impact on cancer research has put the Commonwealth and region on the map. 14 research teams in Louisville are using the collective computing power from Cole County School Districts. Their research has developed 30 potentially life-saving drugs and the largest new drug research pipeline in the country.
I was really amazed, actually. You know, we're not real advanced, but we try to keep up. And we're used to having these older Windows XP computers. And when I walked in, I saw these Macs. I thought, this is awesome. We're finally keeping up.
That's Nathan Jones. He's a junior at Webster County High School. Today, he's in the library for an advanced placement course that he's taking online. It's offered by Murray State University, and he says the one of 32 new iMacs in the Media Lab made that possible.
Like, if you take an online class through Murray, the computers, they have to have a certain specification and requirements in order to run their programs and online courses. If it wasn't for these computers, we probably would not have been able to take those courses. So this is a big help.
Technology opportunities like these have changed the atmosphere at Webster County. No one can tell you that better than Donna.
I'm Donna Fletcher, and I have been teaching in Webster County for 35 years, and I've been the library media specialist for the last 14 years.
She says the new computers in her media center, classrooms, and offices across the district are making a difference for students and staff.
Well, I think it's going to provide opportunities, obviously, for our students, but for the faculty also. As we learn how to use these, it'll provide us all with greater opportunities to use different forms of technology.
And Fletcher says the same goes for students.
I think it was interesting to see how, when our students came in, that they saw these new computers, and, I mean, they were just kind of amazed that we had something like that. And I think it's very positive that this has come from Cole, because we have a lot of students over the years who have graduated from here and gone into the coal mines.
By them leaving the computers on,
English teacher Aaron Harrell again,
they are in some small way possibly helping somebody else to do something important down the road.
For the students Austin Ramsey just told us about, Kentucky Coal is helping fund their new, much-needed computers.
But what about the mine workers who have suffered because they've extracted that coal for decades?
Whitney Jones has more on how government grants have created a place for wheezing miners to get their treatment.
Muhlenberg County had the highest number of deaths in western Kentucky from a mining-specific respiratory disease from 1995 to 2004, making it a prime spot for a specialty clinic. The Coal Miners Respiratory Clinic with yellowing beige walls is housed inside the Muhlenberg Community Hospital and has been there since 1975. Dr. Sanjay Chavda is the head pulmonologist there.
They come here for one particular disease we call black lung, which is pneumoconiosis.
What was that?
Pneumoconiosis.
That's pneumoconiosis, but like Chavda says, most people know it as black lung. Coal-coated lungs are the main health concern for coal miners, especially for those who were in the mines before they used water to tamper the dust stirred up underground. Chavda sits at the clinic underneath a large portrait of a coal miner. A local high school student made the giant piece by writing the names and condition of coal miners who had died in black ink, spacing letters apart so when you step back, you see a man wearing a headlamp. Chavda is a thin Indian man in a white doctor's coat. He smiles kindly before explaining what it's like to be a coal miner with black lung.
Coughing, wheezing, shortness of breath, not able to work very well, or some daily walking and other activities, they get short of breath.
Everybody goes, why are they yelling at them? The coaching, in order to get a valid study, it has to be exactly on cue. A lot of times you'll walk down the hip hall and hear them going, deep breath, deep. You know, they're trying to, and of course the miners are just so hard of hearing, you're just literally screaming at them.
That's the clinic's director, Nancy Cook. She says to test for black lung, miners have to breathe into a tube that's strapped on their face as a nurse instructs and coaches them through the process. If the test results show that a miner has the progressive disease, doctors must then determine which stage of black lung the miner has. A first-stage lung is slightly different from the light, healthy pink color of a normal lung. It's a slightly darker mauve. But get to the fourth stage, and you see why the disease is called black lung.
Pneumoconiosis is not a condition that can be cured. Once you develop it, the damage ongoing stays in your lungs.
Muhlenberg's Coal Miners Respiratory Clinic is one of 15 in the U.S. targeted towards treating coal miners with respiratory issues. Cook says a government grant from the Health Resources and Services Administration partially supports the work they do. The hospital does the rest. The clinic seeks out men and women who worked in the mines and are eligible for testing and benefits and provides them with a counselor to help them through the process. The clinic gives treatment for black lung and has a rehab program to manage the damage done from the coal mines and bad habits like smoking, which exacerbates lung deterioration. But as bad as black lung can be, Dr. Chavda admits regulations have created a much safer place than elsewhere. In his eyes, Kentuckians are lucky to have the protections they do, even if for some of the retired miners it's too late.
What happened to other countries? Not much rules and nobody saying it. Like South America's, their miners are in bad shape, very bad shape.
That was Whitney Jones reporting.
Coming up next, the power of Kentucky coal, how its use today and tomorrow fuel political rhetoric and scientific reason.
This is West Kentucky Coal, People, Places, and Power.
Welcome back to West Kentucky Coal, People, Places, and Power. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton.
Coal wields and yields power, whether it's electricity energizing your coffee pot or the political lightning rod it's become, which is clearly evident in a recent campaign ad for Republican U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell's re-election bid.
You can't tell me we can't figure out how to burn coal that we mine right here in the United States of America and make it work.
Coal makes us sick.
Coal plants shutting down across the country.
The cinematic two-minute video features Democratic Party leaders bashing coal while flashing inspirational images of coal, coal miners, and children with American flags declaring,
"We didn't ask for this, but if it's a war they want, it's a war they'll get.
We can't sit here and take this. We're going to fight these people every step of the way."
So let's get a report from the front. Most of Kentucky's congressmen, including the 1st District's Ed Whitfield, shoulder the fight. Whitfield chairs the House Subcommittee on Energy and Power.
I think it's important that people recognize that what is happening to the coal industry is no big surprise, because Barack Obama, when he was first campaigning for president in San Francisco, made the comment that if I'm elected, people might be able to build coal plants and mine coal, but we'll bankrupt the coal industry.
In fact, President Obama did say something close to that. Here's a little longer snippet of his discussion with the editorial board of the San Francisco Chronicle in 2008.
Let me sort of describe my overall policy. I mean, what I've said is that we would put a cap and trade system in place that is more, that is as aggressive, if not more aggressive, than anybody else's out there. I was the first to call for 100% auction on the cap and trade system. Which means that every unit of carbon or greenhouse gas that was emitted would be charged to the polluter. That they would have to meet the rigors of that market and the ratcheted down caps that are placed, imposed every year. So if somebody wants to build a coal-powered plant, they can. It's just that it will bankrupt them because they're going to be charged a huge sum for all that greenhouse gas that's being emitted.
So if Obama is leading the charge against coal, then his second in command is the Environmental Protection Agency.
I think it's important that the American people do understand precisely what they want to do. They want to eliminate coal. I mean, why would Lisa Jackson come up and testify?
Lisa Jackson is the past EPA administrator under the Obama administration. Gina McCarthy now holds that post.
She point blank told us, when we do our analysis of our regulations and the impact on coal, we don't consider the cost of the loss of jobs in the coal-producing areas. We don't consider the impact on the health of the children of the coal miners when those coal miners lose their health care because they lose their jobs. She said, the only thing that I'm interested in is the health of the American people. And under our models, there's going to be this many people that are not going to have to go to the hospital because of CO2 emissions and particulate matter and whatever.
So, if it were up to campaign ads and sound bites, it's easy to assume that the president and the EPA are killing coal. But it isn't that simple. In fact, it's pretty complicated.
So, would you agree or disagree that there is a, quote, war on coal?
Well, those aren't my words.
Mike Duncan is from Inez, Kentucky, which is about as far east as you can get in the state. Duncan is CEO of the Washington-based American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity, or ACE. And before that, he served as the chairman of the Super PAC American Crossroads. And before that, he was the Republican National Committee chairman.
Certainly, people believe that that they have been casualties of the regulation. And one of the things that we do at ACE is to provide alternatives. We've been working, meeting with the Obama administration, saying, look, we don't believe you have the authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate carbon for existing power plants or new power plants. But if you're going to do the regulation, and we'll have to let the courts decide that later as to whether it's legal, make these regulations that are achievable so that incrementally we can continue to have the leading technology in the world. There are about 15 different ways that you could make coal cleaner now. We want a stronger, cleaner environment, too. The utility industry over the past 30 years has spent over $100 billion putting scrubbers and other devices on power plants to make the nation's air cleaner. We've reduced the particulates by over 90%. We've made huge progress, and the industry wants to continue making that progress, but we have to have standards that are reasonable and that can be met.
Duncan's organization not only represents coal interests, but also the stakeholders in the coal industry, like transportation and coal-powered cooperatives. He doesn't consider ACE a lobbying organization, rather an educational one. In our conversation, I note that he takes a much more conciliatory tone compared to his elected pro-coal counterparts.
I'm eternally optimistic, and I think that if we can get before an audience and educate the audience about the role of coal and how important it is economically for us in the country and how the technology is developing and has developed to improve the quality of life for people and also the quality of air in the country, that we can make that case.
And just as there are some seemingly less politically motivated arguments for the coal industry, there are some reasonable environmentalists also involved in this debate.
Would you say that the picture that's commonly painted of people who are anti-coal by coal activists is accurate?
No. You know, I'm sure that I've heard that people say we're a bunch of, fruitcakes out there waving environmental flags and we'd want to protect the spotted owl and all that stuff.
Rick Fowler is the chairman of the Pennyryle chapter of the Sierra Club. He happens to be the son of a coal miner. He's also delivered coal as a teenager and also marched with coal miner unions during a Labor Day parade as a child. He also taught math in Webster County, Kentucky, home to its fair share of coal mining operations. Fowler is retired now and lives in Owensboro.
I have 8 grandchildren I'm concerned about, and I'd like to see them growing up in a world that, is clean and healthy to live in. Most of the coal activists that I've heard about or know about are people who stand to gain financially from it. They either work for the coal mines or they own the coal mines or they're somehow connected in that way to the coal mines. So I wouldn't say there's anybody out there going, coal's the greatest thing in the world. I have nothing to do with it, but I really believe in coal. There are some people out there who are on the fence about it because they want the electricity. I get that. I want the electricity also. But you haven't seen us demonstrating all over the place. We do some demonstrations here and there, but we're not a bunch of nuts.
While Fowler's arguments against coal are common, reducing CO2 emissions and other greenhouse gases and less physical environmental impacts from coal mining, he and his group have been what he calls somewhat successful in their Beyond Coal campaign by stopping some power plants from being built in the Commonwealth, along with stopping a coal terminal and jet fuel gasification plant in Paducah. They were also instrumental in the retirement of the Green River plant in Muhlenberg County and the defeat of a coal gasification plant in southern Indiana. But in the end, while Fowler is an environmentalist, he's also a realist.
Kentucky receives 90% of its energy from coal, while nationwide, the country receives 40% of its energy from coal. So there's a stronger diversification going on at the national level. How do you see the energy sector in Kentucky changing?
It's going to be difficult because the coal is so powerful. So I'm not sure how we're going to be able to do this. All I know is it has to be done.
She blinded me with science. She blinded me with science.
So the factors surrounding coal's overall decline involve an uptick in cleaner-burning natural gas power plants, a growing but still relatively small renewable energy market, and tightening restrictions on coal-fired power plant emissions due to the ongoing debate on whether or not CO2 is contributing to climate change. And whether or not one agrees with CO2's impact on climate change, advances in scientific research are the only way to meet impending emissions requirements facing those plants. Jack Grappo is an engineer at the University of Kentucky's Center for Applied Energy Research.
I've worked with energy and energy production for my entire career, and it's always been political. It does seem to be more highly partisan and charged right now, I would say. It has a significant impact on the things that we do. I spent the last 15 years working on developing coal ash utilization strategies. I don't do that anymore because there simply is no funding, and nobody has an interest in commercial development of something that may or may not be labeled hazardous by the federal government. And where all the funding seems to be concentrated right now is in CO2 capture.
And that's just what he and many other scientists across the U.S. are working on. Grappo is using microalgae to capture and sequester, or in its case, eat, the CO2 for food. But Grappo says in all the capture and sequestration research he knows of, the scale is far too large and the price too high to see immediate commercialization. But SIU Carbondale Coal Research Center Director Thomas Witowski is optimistic.
This is what a lot of people are calling war on the coal. I disagree with it. I'm, as being researcher and scientist, I believe in the power of science and research. Being scientist, I'm always saying that's fun to solve problems and nothing is impossible. I'm always following Einstein quote, who said impossible takes longer. So in this case, you have to spend more time working harder, but we'll find a solution.
Coal's history in West Kentucky is clear. What's less clear is its present and future.
We know what coal gives us and the problems it brings with us, but it's plentiful. It's the most abundant fossil fuel on the planet.
And as long as we draw close to 40% of our electricity from coal nationwide, there will be a need to take it out of the ground and for the men and women to do so.
The debate will continue, but so will the research, scientific and historical, probably until the last miner brings up that last piece of coal.
West Kentucky Coal, People, Places, and Power is a production of WKMS News. The program was produced by Chad Lampe, Todd Hatton, Whitney Jones, John Knoll, John Walker, Austin Ramsey, and Rob Canning.
We'd like to thank Warrior Coal, the Tennessee Valley Authority, and its Paradise Fossil Plant, the Coal Miners Respiratory Clinic at Muhlenberg County Hospital, Hobbies Classic Foods in Greenville, Kentucky, the Panorama Group at the Sierra Club's Cumberland Chapter, and the United Mine Workers of America, Local 1605.
We'd also like to thank Mike Foster, Barry Duvall, Milton Atkins, J.D. Masters, Doug Swain, and Murray State University's Chair of the Department of Geosciences, Dr. George Kippett.
And our thanks also go to WUKY and WSIU for their technical assistance. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. Thanks for listening.